Yes, that is, I don't know if it's an urban myth, but that certainly has been out there quite a lot. The windows are also a little dark. They're dark glass, and so that doesn't help. So there are some discussions about what could be done to improve the windows. Peter and I stood outside the building a month or two ago and were talking about how to make them bigger. It's challenging. I personally think that what should happen, it's very rare for a building that's considered historic, even though it's only 30 years old, to have its architect still living. And Michael Graves is still alive and still very opinionated, and I think that he could probably help figure out how to make it a viable building.
Well, it's fascinating that we're having a debate and we're talking about this building, because from get-go, from day one, the competition which led to the winning selection of this building had the exact same debate about the window size and about the style of the building and what could be done with the resources that were available. So I think we have to be very careful that we're not blaming the resources that were available and the results of the competition outline, because of the three proposals that were, there was only one that met the public criteria for the whole program as well as the budget, and that was the one that eventually got built. I think what we're seeing now, though, is once we're working in that building and once we're observing how it's moving around, it's not functioning very well from the user standpoint. And so, as Becca mentioned, Michael Graves is alive. This is a very important building for him. And he has had thoughts about how to address the windows. He has had thoughts about how to address the ground floor. And he has had 30 years to think about this building. And so we have to suspend our current thoughts about it and see where we go from here.
I think there's also a great opportunity that this kind of problem provides, in that most historic preservation, specifically as Becca noted, of significant, internationally significant buildings, is either a matter of a faithful restoration or tearing it down. And I think the circumstances with the Portland building give us an opportunity to think creatively about a kind of third way in which some of the best aspects of the building are preserved, but we might take a little bit more liberty with respect to solving some of the interior problems or some of the windows. And so there can be a kind of potentially a wonderful hybrid of old and new there.
Well, isn't the postmodern of the building all on the outside, it's all superficial, right? It's like the fake columns and that. It's not the actual box itself.
It is. And my position originally, I was trained as a modernist. I'm an ardent modernist, and I like buildings to be a little bit more direct and truthful about what they are. So I think I was pretty much trained to dislike postmodernism, but I recognize that I'm not alone in that camp, but postmodernism is very popular with some people. That it's just because I don't like it doesn't mean it's not valid, and it is a very important example of postmodern architecture. So, and actually, I think we're facing a revival of postmodernism now. I think that people
already.
Yes, I think so. We're at the tail end of a revival of modernism, well, and out of that is coming more interest in whimsy. If you look at Michael Graves' progression as a young architect, he started off as a white box modernist. He was always a little bit more whimsical, but he definitely was very early on interested in the use of color and became very interested in history, and that's what led him into his sort of postmodern career, and I think that we're beginning to see that again.
I think there's also an interesting lesson here in that across societies and across different periods in history, there's this long tendency for the public to say, you know, that building that's 30 years old or 50 years old, that's not so great, but the 100-year-old building, that's really great. That's the one we've got to preserve. But if a building can't reach its 30th birthday or its 50th birthday, then it's never going to reach that 100th birthday.
Mm-hmm. Well, could it be that there's lots of things you could do on the inside and but just keep that basic look on the outside?
Certainly the inside has already been heavily modified. From day second, third year, it was starting to be modified. So yes, there are things you can do on the inside. I think it's the type of building, though, if the windows and the size of the windows and the location of the windows and the appearance of what looks like ribbon windows, vertical ribbon windows, in fact, are only glass over a square opening, one could argue, well, is it possible in this building, concrete building, could you make at least where these glass windows are, bring the truthfulness back into the building, as Becca said, and a way to introduce long spans of opening that more light gets deeper into it. The fact that it is dark glass in itself limits the amount of light. So even moving to a shade of glass that allows more light to enter deeper into the space will improve the way that people feel about the space. So it does ask the question, what can be done to improve it as a functional building? So we don't necessarily have to demolish it in its entirety because of the feeling that we don't hate it. And again, I think it's very much localized. So that Portland are the ones who are the higher percentage of the people who will be so advocating that they dislike it. Mm-hmm. And I think if we move beyond that, and it's also very generational. I think people who perhaps they were just born when the building was completed or were born slightly after the building was completed, they have a whole different perspective on the era because they didn't grow up with it. It mm-hmm. is history to them. And so they look at it through a different lens as what might be important.
I feel like Portland just got lucky that it has this first of its kind building. Is there something about the way Portland is going about debating it? You know, would this building be safer in another city, or would it be already gone?
I think the fact that it's the first is what makes it important. I actually think the fact that it has Portlandia on it, the statue, the sculpture, also makes it important. If it was in another, I think that if it was the third or the fourth of its kind, it would be a less significant building and would face a more uncertain future.
Also, Portland is not a city that is known for having architecture by a lot of internationally famous architects. Seattle, our neighbor to the north, is the city known for that. They've got buildings by Frank Gehry and Rem Koolhaas and Stephen Hall and some of the top architects in the world of their generation. And Portland is a city that's known more for being a well-designed city and what architects would call the urban fabric and the collections of buildings and blocks and transit and parks and how it all fits together. And that's really the genius design of Portland is Portland. So maybe here the building might have a better chance to survive in a way because it's not like we have so many other masterpieces or landmarks to fall back on. And as this conversation is getting to as well, you know, some of the other landmarks in the city are threatened too.
Mm-hmm. So the Memorial Coliseum, Brian, just tell us, when was that built and who wants to tear that down?
Memorial Coliseum was built in 1960 by one of the top architecture firms of the 20th century, Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, who designed buildings like the New World Trade Center or the Sears Tower in Chicago or the world's current tallest building, the Burj Khalifa Tower in Dubai. And Memorial Coliseum really epitomizes the genius of mid-century modern architecture in the vein of architects like Mies van der Rohe and Le Corbusier. It was primarily a home for the Trailblazers basketball team and a lot of other community events for most of its life. And then when the Blazers team moved to the Rose Garden Arena next door in 1996, the Coliseum still remained active as it does today, but in a declining way. And so it still gets about 100 events a year right now, but that's dwindling because there's a lot of deferred maintenance. There's a kind of strange relationship between the Trailblazers and the city in terms of how it's run. It's a city-owned building, but they allow the Trailblazers team to run both Memorial Coliseum and the Rose Garden so they don't compete with each other. But that also gives the Blazers a kind of natural incentive to book more events in the Rose Garden and not do some of the deferred maintenance that the Coliseum should have all along. But there's really a kind of tragic disconnect between the city of Portland and this building in that it's vastly more exceptional and architecturally significant and even a masterpiece than people realize because its best feature has been hidden away. Memorial Coliseum is actually either one of the only arenas in the world or perhaps even the only arena in the world with a 360-degree view from the seats to the outside. So it's designed so you're watching a basketball game or the Rose Parade or a concert and able to have a 360-degree view. So you're sitting in your seats and you're looking at the entire downtown Portland skyline and the Willamette River. And it's literally one of the most breathtaking architectural experiences of any kind that I've ever had. I think there's only two times when architecture has brought tears to my eyes. One was at Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water House in Pennsylvania. And one was being in Memorial Coliseum with the curtain open and able to see the whole city from my seats. But that curtain, there's been a black curtain that has blocked off the view for about 99% of the building's history.
Why is there a curtain?
Concert promoters and basketball teams don't want something as unpredictable as an interior arena with a view to the outside, because it doesn't really exist except for Memorial Coliseum. So you have an irony in that the precise thing that makes this building an absolutely breathtaking architectural experience is also that which they want to lock away, just in order to make the building, make the arena just like every other arena.
So, Becca, as a modernist, do you rate this building?
I think it's the best, or one of the very best in Portland. It's very pure. I appreciate Brian's comment. I haven't experienced it with the curtains open, but even without that experience, the fact that it's a pure glass box that contains a pure bowl, it's just a beautiful piece of sculpture, and I think it works beautifully in the city. It's become neglected, and it's certainly negatively influenced by everything that's happening around it now, and I think it needs all the help it can get.
This is a building that is four city blocks in size, but is standing on just four columns. You know, here in this radio studio, there are probably 10 columns. And so you have a 10,000-seat arena standing on four columns, and the concrete seating bowl sits completely detached from the glass box that surrounds it. So in other words, a lot of architecture starts out with some simple, pure idea, but by necessity gets kind of dumbed down along the way. This building was never dumbed down, and so, as Beck is saying, it remained the kind of aesthetically pure building that the architects wanted, and yet it has practical value as well. I remember interviewing one of the original architects of this building, and he said, you know, honestly, most of the buildings I designed, I get lost in, like hospitals or other arenas, but I knew when I was designing Memorial Coliseum that that would never happen, because no matter where you were in the arena, you'd always be able to look to the outside and know exactly where you were.
But as with the Portland building, the Memorial Coliseum has some problems.
Sure.
And it's not just operational, it's not just management problems. I think it's that there are some fundamental problems with how it now functions as a building. And I think that both the Portland building and the Coliseum, to have viable futures, they have to find ways to be effective.
So what we're talking about and continue to talk about is, so Memorial Coliseum, 1960, a little bit over 50 years old. If you look at Coliseums nationally, it was a time period where cities were trying to put themselves on the map with public infrastructure through urban renewal plans, and multi-purpose arenas were key to cities to do that. And as the sports world became more refined and teams grew in popularity, they wanted single-use event space. And so when the Moda Center was constructed, it initially wanted to go on the Memorial Coliseum site. And the city had the foresight to say, well, wait a minute, this was public dollars that went into this. We'll make infrastructure available for this new arena adjacent to it. The two would probably benefit each other and help each other with a variety of events. But we aren't going to put public dollars into tearing it down. And it continues to suffer the same type of pressure, in which the public infrastructure and the dollars to go to it and finding a continued use for what was designed as multi-purpose in a very large building. How do you continue to do this? And then what is happening around it? So I think the comments that it's very much tied to its location is critical in what moves forward. But we have to think outside the box, recognize it in the larger context that it's a 50-year-old building. It needs something to improve it, but not necessarily tear it down isn't going to fix the bigger area around it. So it will benefit from the larger picture and really being open and available to what that would be.
So you're saying if the development around it improves, you can keep that sort of perfect sculpture?
Yeah, and the development around it is kind of a potential gold mine. It's on one hand a bit of a dead zone now, and that's part of the urban planning problem in that when there's not an event, there's hardly anyone outside these two arenas. But we've invested recently in a streetcar going along the northern edge of the property, which acted as a real development tool across the river for the Pearl District. And this area of Northeast Portland near the river and near the Lloyd District is viewed as ultimately a kind of second downtown. And so the city already has a lot of high density plans around Memorial Coliseum. So as kind of badly situated as it is now, it may be an asset to it in the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I've just found out that architects don't listen to music while they're working. Above all that.
No, lots of them do.
Do they? So Brian has brought in a bit of jazz. It's Rassan Roland Kirk playing the Creole Love Call. Well, that actually wasn't the Creole Love Call. It was something else from the album The Inflated Tear. But just tell us why you like that, Brian.
Rassan Roland Kirk has always been a favorite of mine because he combines the virtuoso chops of a great musician with the sort of enthusiasm and unbridled play of a street musician. I first heard this album when I was visiting London for the first time years ago, and it's just one that's always stuck with me. I really think it's a masterpiece, and that Rassan Roland Kirk is someone deserving more attention, and I still listen to this record all the time.
Mm-hmm. And it helps you when you're working on your blog, the Portland Architecture blog,
right.
Which is actually has come a long, long way, and I'm very proud of you for the sticking at it. And it's the place people go when they want to read about Portland architecture.
Yeah, blog has already kind of become a bit of an outdated term, but I really wanted to have the chance over time to try and shape an online design magazine covering architecture in Portland, especially since our daily paper seems to be resembling the Titanic.
So, Peter, there's another building. It's on Highway 30 as you're heading off to, like, Hovey's Island or somewhere. It's an old gas and coke building. People probably know it. Do you know much about it?
You know, I don't know a whole lot about it, other than the fact that it seems like each year the architectural students down at the University of Oregon's program select that building as a thesis project. I also know it because it seems like every one of my friends who isn't an architect and doesn't really pay attention to architecture knows that building and is always asking me, was that an old school building? You know, was that an old railway station, as Brian has described it? And it's fascinating because it's a type of building that technically has a history. It does have a history. Is it historic? Can be argued. It certainly isn't elevated to the sense that it's on the National Register of Historic Places, either locally or nationally. But yet, there's something about it that resonates with every person thinking that it must have a history and it must be an important history. And, oh, what are we doing about it to keep it? And we couldn't be further from that truth, as Brian has written about in his online architecture magazine, that for the longest time, it's been abandoned, certainly since for the last 20 years, as far as I know, if not even
I
further.
I think since the 1950s.
So there you go. And it's
on a Superfund site, right?
And it's on a Superfund
site. So you wouldn't want to drink the puddles around there.
Absolutely. And it's been written that you can't even go into it, and because if you do, you'll glow after you come out of it. And so it's a fascinating one, and I'm interested to listen to the renewed interest on a larger format on just what does the future of the building hold for.
I think there's a kind of third way, just as I was talking about with the Portland building, in that some of the supporters of the building that have advocated that, especially especially given the compromised nature of the site, that we should allow the Gasco building to decay as a kind of natural ruin. And since we're having to transform the soil itself from a Superfund site, that this would be an excellent opportunity to create some kind of riverfront park, because the property and the building are right on the river. You know, Seattle, for example, has done this with Gasworks Park. And so, you know, the Gasco building is practically right across the Willamette River from Cathedral Park in the shadow of the St. John's Bridge. So Northwest Natural, the landowner, is busy cleaning up this site anyway, and you know, it's a bit isolated, but you know, why not a park? And allowing the building to decay as a ruin would still fit in with what people love about it, which is it's a kind of mysterious building with a patina, and it's not something that people inhabit, but that they admire from afar, and that could still happen.
I think that building is an idea. You know, we all drive by it. It's so sort of romantic and a little frightening. Looks like a horror movie set. It's got things growing out of it. And so we all sort of identify with it as a sort of childhood fantasy almost. And Brian, you told me it's actually in Colin Molloy's latest Wildwood book.
Yes, children's book.
Yeah. So you know, we all know it, but does it have any future? It's going to take, given that it's made out of concrete, it's going to take forever to disintegrate. And maybe it should just stay there as an inaccessible, really kind of cool icon and just stay the way it is.
I agree.
Peter, would you go there if it was renovated?
I would go to the park along the river, and like everyone else, it's just fun to read about that plaque about what this building was and have a little steer, and maybe the clock in the clock tower could once again chime.
And I think there's a larger lesson here in that people value Portland because it's got this wonderful urban fabric, and you know, building by building, that's really becoming threatened as the economy starts to boom again.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week, our guests were architectural writer Brian Libby and the architects Peter Major and Becca Cavell. And they were talking about the Portland Building, Memorial Coliseum, and the Gasco Building. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol, looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
Good day. It's Tuesday, April 15th, 2014. You are listening to news headlines at noon in English and Spanish on KBOO. I'm Kelly Sunrose. Today is tax day in the United States. This is the deadline for paying federal income taxes and state income taxes in Oregon. Additionally, it is the deadline for paying the arts tax in the city of Portland. Residents of the city of Portland pay an annual arts tax of $35. If you haven't paid or filed for an exemption, you can visit portlandoregon.gov online to find out more. An Army Major General denied Chelsea Manning's petition for clemency yesterday, upholding her 35-year sentence for releasing sensitive government documents to the website WikiLeaks. Manning was sentenced in August of 2013 and has been held in military prison at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas since then. This petition begins the appeals process for Manning. The next step in the appeals process is the Army Court of Criminal Appeals. Chelsea Manning was formerly known as Bradley and is in the process of a formal name change. You've been listening to news headlines at noon on KBOO. This is Kelly Sunrose. For more local, national, and global news produced right here in our Portland studios, tune in weekdays at 5 p.m.
And now, Spanish headlines. La ciudad de Boston rinde este martes un homenaje a las víctimas del atentado perpetrado hace un año en su maratón y que dejó un saldo de 3 muertos y 264 heridos. En las primeras horas del día se llevó a cabo una ceremonia dirigida por el vicepresidente Joe Biden. Los organizadores rindieron homenaje a aquellos afectados por los acontecimientos del año pasado, incluyendo a quienes perdieron sus vidas, los sobrevivientes, familiares y socorristas. Además, el 21 de abril se llevará a cabo el tradicional maratón al cual se han inscrito 36.000 personas. Esto quiere decir que son 9.000 más que en la edición del 2013. Esta cifra ha convertido al maratón en la segunda con mayor número de atletas en su historia. Las autoridades incrementarán las medidas de seguridad y han anunciado que estarán prohibidas las mochilas voluminosas y serán exhaustivos los controles de seguridad, por lo que se pide de la comprensión y apoyo de los participantes. Rechazan la petición de prisión domiciliaria para los paraguayos que están en huelga de hambre desde hace 56 días, luego del caso conocido como la masacre de Curuguaiti. Los campesinos están acusados, sin sustento, de tentativa de homicidio, asociación criminal e invasión de inmueble ajeno y fueron detenidos desde junio de 2012. El pasado miércoles, el juzgado de Guairá, donde han sido juzgadas estas personas, dio a conocer que se rechazaba la prisión domiciliaria y se negó a entregar la documentación a la defensa jurídica de los campesinos, lo cual demorará la posibilidad de apelación y seguirá alargando la agonía de los huelguistas. Esto es todo por el momento. Les informó Tania Gómez Daza.
No tengo mucha plata, pero tengo cobre.
Aquí se baila como bailan los pobres.
Las bolas en los boquetes como Tiger Woods. Tú eres clase alta, yo clase baja. Tú vistes de seda y yo de paja. Nos complementamos como novios. Tú tomas agua destilada, yo agua con microbios. Tú la vives fácil y yo me fajo. Tú sudas perfume, yo subo trabajo. Tú tienes chofer, yo